Hey, Cliff Goldstein here, and welcome to the show. I was in a used bookstore the other day, wandering through the shelves, and I came across this book which grabbed my attention. It was called Delmore Swartz, The Life of an American Poet. And it caught my attention because I was knew that I was going to be doing one of my shows on him, so I bought the book hoping that it would help me as I did the show. So you see how hard I work for you people? Do you appreciate it? Yeah, I'm sure, like my teenagers do. Anyway, Delmore Swartz was born in 1912, died in 1966, and in his time he received a fair amount of fame for his poetry and literary criticism and short stories, and was born in New York and lived there most of a sad and pretty unhappy life. Swartz obviously was Jewish, born in a family of immigrants from Romania, and the father made a decent living, was well off financially, but that was about all he really offered the family. He was a philanderer and eventually ran off and abandoned the family and left a mother and two small boys. And as usual in cases like that, it's the kids who suffer the most. And I really don't think poor Delmore ever really recovered from what happened with his dad. And it might help explain how he grew up, became an alcoholic, went insane, and died pretty young. In fact, he one time wrote this wonderful short story. It was the one that really first gave him some fame. It was called In Dreams Begin Responsibilities. And it's about this man who's dreaming. And he's dreaming he's in a movie theater. And he's dreaming he's watching this movie. And the movie that's playing across is his father courting his mother. It's like he's taken back in time and seeing the courtship of his parents take place. Well, all through the movie, as it's playing, he jumps up and starts yelling at the people, yelling at his parents on the screen. And the usher has to constantly keep coming in and telling him to be quiet, because if something upsets him, he's yelling and screaming and it's disturbing the other. Patrons. Well, there's this one scene in the movie as he's watching when he sees his parents get moving towards getting married, and he jumps up in the theater and he shouts, "Don't do it! It's not too late to change your minds, both of you. Nothing good will come out of it. Only remorse, hatred, scandal, and two children's whose characters are monstrous." Nothing good will come out of it, only scandal, remorse, hatred, two children whose characters are monstrous. It's a powerful story. And as I said, Swartz ended up dying young, drunk, and mentally ill. And it was kind of sad, too, because the older he got, the more fame he got, the more crazier he became. It's like the fame he wanted, and then he would really get it, and then yet each time he would fall deeper into depression, deeper into despair. Yeah, Delmore Swartz, it was a very sad ending to a very sad story. Of course, at least he didn't kill himself like so many well-known poets of his, you know, Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton. They ended up killing himself. He died drunk and miserable and insane instead. I guess that's better. I don't know. Anyway, though, my interest in Delmore Swartz and why I wanted to do a program on him comes from a short story he wrote called The Statues. And it was incredible. And it goes like this. It was in the mid-20th century, and it says in the mid-20th century, and let me get it here now. Let me find it here for you. The mid-20th century. All right, here we go. All right, I got it together here. Okay. In the mid-20th century, and an extraordinary, inescapable, and even terrifying event had occurred. What happened? Well, there was this massive snowfall overnight, and all through the city, it had created these beautiful statues. The people came out in these beautiful statues of, he says, of curious design and unquestionable design, some of which were very human, had been created in the snow. And more than that, they had the hardness of rocks which could not be removed from the pavement. In other words, it hardened. The snow fell, created these beautiful statues all through New York City. Well, anyways, the story goes on. Everybody pours out in the streets to stare at the statues. They're awed by the amazing array of shapes. People were amazed at this incredible phenomena. And then he writes here in the story, he goes, "Hence it was that the whole day after the snowfall became an unofficial holiday or fete. All private concerns were ignored. All tasks absentmindedly attended to. All other things put aside while everyone discussed, analyzed, and sought an explanation of the remarkable statues of snow. Now, what happened was that when the mayor announced at one point that the statues would be removed, his office was assaulted by telegrams by people, "Don't you dare touch them." The people rose up in arms. See, I guess there was something special about these statues. They didn't know what, but they certainly going to let some unimaginative Gotham bureaucrat ruin them. Now, among those who concerned and interested in the statues was a 30-year-old dentist in the story. His name, if you want to use the word hero, his name was Faber Gottschalk. And as I said, he was a dentist, and according to the story, he says he was unable to understand his passionate concern about statues, but determined to do nothing all day but walk around and look at them. Now, it's kind of an interesting character, this Gottschalk. He kind of reminded me of his own ways, of Albert Camus' character in his novel The Stranger. Gottschalk in this Faber was sort of an aloof, empty kind of guy who hated his work as a dentist. I think this is important. He says here, to seek out pus and decay and to do this day after day, to have this in the forefront of one's consciousness, these central aspects of his profession he disliked, did not get used to, and certainly would never regard with anything but aversion. Okay, so basically, as a result, according to this, he constantly evaded anything that came to himself. It kind of just ruined him. Well, anyway, dentistry had alienated him from pretty much anything that got too close. Except these statues. He found himself fascinated by them. So enthralled by these things that he canceled all appointments and he put out his door on the side of his business until further notice. And then according to the story, he spent the rest of the day walking up and down the city, looking at the shapes, which disclosed, he said, even more interesting. They seemed more interesting each time he looked at them. It's funny, that evening in his apartment, after he walked around, and then he says here, he sat around and he smoked a cigar, and he was thinking about the statue. And then he says here, very interesting, he said, after he reviewed the day in his mind, he smoked one cigar after another, gratified by the tobacco and yet able to distinguish clearly between the pleasures of smoking and the great happiness which had come upon him when he had awakened to see the strange snow things below his apartment window. So I guess the point here was the statue somehow gave him a pleasure that transcended the pleasure of a good smoke. Okay. Now, in New York City, life went on as before, but not as before. For instance, there would be strikers, bosses, policemen. Though contending on the streets, every now and then they would stop and stare at fascination in these statues. In other words, they'd almost be in the middle of a riot, but then something would catch their attention. I mean, somehow they would get their mind on the statues, and they would stop and they would look. Again, he writes about that. He says, let me see here. He says, at certain times, the statues would just, I don't know even where the quote is. Anyway, the point is, the statues, we would just look at the statues, and it would grab their attention, and so on and so forth, and it just absorbed them. And though bars, restaurants, museums, and all that, they lost patronage, things went on as usual, but everybody was influenced one way or the other by the beauty of these statues that filled New York. Now, no one, though, seemed to have been as powerfully impacted by the statues as Faber Gottschalk. They literally changed his life. He writes here, let me see if I can find this one now. I marked it up. He writes here, in the story, he writes, or what's his name? Gottschalk didn't write, but Schwartz wrote. He wrote here that nothing had absorbed him like these statues to the degree that they did. All right, come on. All righty. Yeah, let me see here. So, all right, hey, here we go. Faber Gottschalk alone surrendered the being of his past life utterly, ceased to practice his profession, and went through the conscious day through New York in an effort to see all the statues. So he left his past life absorbed in the statues. And though they came in many forms, humans, flowers, animals, gargoyles, all this stuff, there was one that was very obscene, and the citizens demand that it be dynamited. Well, instantly there was a big uproar in the city, and people went and they stood on the street corner and argued to a crowd. At one place he argued, "Since we really do not understand these extraordinary objects, must we not, from the motives of humility, prudence, and practicality, regard them as sacred mysteries, at least for the time being? Who knows," he said, "what relationship they might have to our lives?" And the crowd cheered, and Faber stepped down, and the statues remained. Anyway, for 10 days after the statues first appeared, the weather remained crisp and clear, and the city was still enthralled by these statues as if they became a permanent part of their lives, especially for Faber, whose life was consumed by them. What happens? Well, towards the end of the story, and then, without warning, a tireless foul rain descended and, to everyone's surprise, utterly destroyed the teeny statues. The papers the next day noticed the incident, you know, but then that was pretty much it. Life carried on as before. The problems, the stresses, everything returned as they had not been erupted by this thing. And here's how Schwartz ended the story, the last paragraph of Delmar Schwartz's The Statues. "A particularly brutal murder was committed in Brooklyn. The sports page carried much news about ice sports at the winter resorts. A boy of 17, scion of a very rich family, disappeared from his home and was found in Iceland 2 weeks later. Faber-Goshlock jumped or fell in front of an oncoming subway train, and only a few were sufficiently disturbed to keep in mind, with the help of photographs, the holy time when statues had presented their marvelous forms everywhere in the city of New York. The holy time when the statues appeared in the city of New York." Now, what was that all about? What was the point of the story? The statues, I believe, were a metaphor for meaningless. Faber-Goshlock found in those statues something beautiful. He found some meaning for from the monotony of his life. Unable to articulate what it was, remember he said, who knows what those relationships they'll have. He was nevertheless drawn by their mystery of beauty. I mean, a man who spent his days in people's mouths, finally found something beyond himself, something that transcended the ordinariness of life. You know, I can remember after the Iraq War started and casualties, there was an article about a family, about a boy who was killed over there. He was some high school kid who had pretty much been indifferent to everything, dropped out of college, wasn't really doing anything but partying. Then the war started, and he watched the war on TV, and the next thing you know, the kid got serious, and he joined the army. Came home and told his family he joined the army, and the parents couldn't understand. And before leaving, the kid said something very interesting. He said, "I want to be a part of something bigger than myself." And you think about that, people. Why not? Think about our lives. Think about what we are. What are we but small packets of flesh carrying around within us our own fecal matter and not far away our own minds, a couple of pounds of carbon-based organic material closer in composition to a bucket of Kentucky Fried Chicken than to a hard drive? What can these small, what can these small self-contained packets mean in contrast to the infinity that surrounds us? To live only for yourself, to live only something no bigger than yourself when there's so much beyond us? You know, it's like being locked in solitary confinement in a large city when all this other stuff is going on around. And then it's not just our bodies. Think about human consciousness. Think about how small our sense of ourselves are, of our consciousness. There's the body, which is small to begin with around everything, and then you've got the individual consciousness, which sort of exists inside the body. Our own immediate sense of ourself is kind of limited to our own consciousness. It's something so private, so personal, something so inscrutably locked within this clump of meat. You know, what can it mean? It's so small and so isolated. And what is self-consciousness? It's just this fragile electrochemical flame. I guess that's a way to describe it. Chemicals and neuron going, and then boom, just like that, it stops. We're not much compared to the main, much less to the Crab Nebula. And I guess the point on all this is, It's no wonder people sense the need for something to live beyond themselves, beyond the self-contained packet of flesh, including the consciousness that exists in a few pounds of matter crammed between our ears. That's us. That's us in all our glory. How ironic, then, in order to find meaning for ourselves, we need to find it from something bigger than ourselves. Yet considering how who we are, how small we are, you know, where else would we look? You know, sometimes we hear about the rich and famous, these beautiful people, and yet how miserable and wretched they are. They're fawned on by the world, their existence, everything surrounded all around them, and they have everything. Only how long does it take before they realize it doesn't work? You can't get meaning out of meaninglessness no matter any more than you can get one out of zero, no matter how hard you try. I mean, to center your life around yourself is to center it on something that's meaningless, and sooner or later everybody catches on. And how they respond, well, that's often the stuff of headlines that you see in supermarket tabloids and so on. Now, and so Faber-Goshlock was drawn to these statues. They pulled something out of him. They gave him something beyond himself. And it went, you know, he was arguing over the meaning of the statues, and he said it drew him out. It gave him a meaning to his life. Now, after his speech on the car about the obscene statue, a stranger had confronted him, saying he didn't think he'd all bent out of shape over the statue. Shouldn't let them interrupt his life because they weren't that important. Faber responded, and this is what he said. He said, if one becomes sufficiently interested, wholly absorbed, and absolutely involved in any one thing or any one passion, then that one passion becomes the whole world for one. The whole world appears once more in it, and with more intensity and clarity. So the point is, everything suddenly became so important to him through that. It becomes the whole world. In other words, it gave him a reason to live. Now that might have been fine, and it's wonderful that Faber found meaning in the statues, whatever that meaning was, this transcendence. But there was one problem. And this tireless foul rain destroyed that meaning, destroyed that whole world, just like that. He found something to give it his life meaning, only to have it what? Washed away by water? So you see, we need something beyond these isolated packets of flesh, this mortal flesh that's withering away. People whose our thoughts, our feelings are all wrapped in ourselves. And yet whatever we find, you know, it can be just as futile, just as fleeting as what we're trying to transcend. See, it's one thing to sense the own immediate meaningless, the realization that by living only yourself, you're living for what? A pile of meat that's never more than a step away from being fly food. But to strive for something beyond ourselves, to strive for something to show that our life matters, and then, you know, and even in the end, we've done that, we're still dead and gone, and whatever we've discovered usually is meaningless as well. See, it's interesting, Delmore wrote a poem. He wrote a poem about, I guess in many ways, it's from his, it says the same thing. And he says, as for my part, and I for my part felt in my heart as one who falls in a parachute, falls endlessly, and feel the vast draft of the abyss sucking him down and down, and endlessly, helplessly falling an appalled clown. This is the way the night passes by. This is the overnight endless trip to the famous unfathomable abyss. Nothing. It's all an unfathomable abyss. This makes me think of another short story. This was written by Frenchman Guy de Maupassant called The Necklace. And it tells about this woman named Matilda. She was married to a clerk. She was kind of hated her life. She was bored, you know, felt she belonged to greater things. Well, one day the husband gets invited to a fancy ball, to a fancy dance, and she didn't want to go, but eventually he talks her into it, and they borrow a fancy necklace because they can't afford it. And she goes to the ball, and she was the hit of the ball. Everybody, they triumph of her beauty, and she just had a great time, and it was like the best night of her life. She was the hit of the ball. She had some of the glory she wanted. The only trouble is they get home, and they discover that they lost the necklace. And the necklace was supposedly worth, you know, 36,000 francs, which was, you know, I don't know, $500,000 back then. This story took place in the 1800s. Well, they look and they look and they look and they can't find the necklace. They can't find the necklace. And the rest of the story is basically about him borrowing all this money to pay it, and then they ruin their lives. They spend the next 10 years of their lives trying to earn the money back to pay, because they borrowed here, they borrowed there, and for a decade, every dime was paid against the debt until their lives were ruined. Well, anyway, they sell their souls paying back the money. Then one Sunday, years later, Matilda's walking along the Champs-Élysées, and she sees Mrs. Forrester. She's the one whom she borrowed the money from, and Miss Forrester looked great. Well, anyway, this haggard old woman walks up to her, and Mrs. Forrester doesn't know who it is at first. And then when she realized, she says, "What happened to you, Matilda?" And then Matilda explained. She said she had ruined their lives in order to replace the necklace that they had lost, that they borrowed from her. Then after hearing the whole story, Mrs. Forrester looks at her and she says to her, "You say that you bought a diamond necklace to replace mine?" "Yes," Matilda answers. "You did not perceive it then? They were just alike." And she smiled with a proud and simple joy. Madam Forrester was touched and took both her hands, and she replied, "Oh, my poor Matilda, mine were false. They were not worth over 500 francs. Now, I think the message of Guy de Maupassant's The Necklace should be obvious. It says, don't spend your life doing meaningless things. But suppose, though, I ask the question, suppose it's not just the things that we do that are meaningless. Suppose it's life itself is meaningless. Suppose that poor clerk and Matilda's whole story were metaphors for human existence. We struggle, we work hard, we do everything for what? To die, and our legacy's left to those who will die too, and on and on. Or suppose we work so hard and a foul rain comes, as in Delmar Schwartz's statue, and ruins it all. Considering what science tells us about the fate of the universe, as I said on other shows, it's either going to burn up or blow out or blow up or come back on a big crunch. What does anything mean? Let me read you a quote from a Spanish writer, Miguel de Unamuno. And again, it might be a little pessimistic, it might be a little negative, but who's going to argue with the logic here? "Must I again declare to you the supreme vacuity of culture, of science, of art, of good, of truth, of beauty, of justice? All these beautiful conceptions, if at the last, in 4 days or 4 millions of centuries, it matters not which, no human consciousness shall exist to appropriate the civilization, the science, this good, this art, the beauty, and all the rest." In other words, what could it possibly mean? You know, life at its best, when life is good, can be so full of frustrations and struggles. Then when it's bad, what does it all mean? There's no answer key, it seems. There's no story in the back of the book. It doesn't end with us living happily ever after. Most don't live happily to begin with, and none live ever after. It's sort of like a farce. It's a tragedy bordering on a farce, like poor Faber-Goshlock, or even worse, for Delmar Schwartz. If human existence is a struggle for survival, survival of the fittest, it's tough luck, because in the end, even the fittest don't survive. Maybe our genes do, but that's it. You know, there's this guy, he has the selfish gene theory, and he says that all we are, that Darwin had it wrong, all we are is survival machines. Survival of the fittest isn't for the species, it's just for the genes to survive. Sort of like as a chicken is to an egg, to create eggs, humans are nothing but a gene's way of making more genes. And it's interesting, there was I got a poem here about a woman who was doing some reading about DNA about what DNA does, and sort of mocking this whole idea that we could find our meaning in our genes. And in the poem, this woman is laying in bed next to her husband, and she says, "The shape, do you see? There is a shape. There was an organizational pattern anchoring us, despite the overwhelming flux of this and thatness, anchoring us, explaining us. There is a field of neural patterns she can conjure up now from the depths of her body's own unknown, unlit, invisible layers, and commune with something stabler and greater than any one life. Of course she weeps. Of course this changes everything." In other words, of course, now she knows that all the meaning is found in the genes. It kind of makes me think of Monty Python, who says that humans are simply spiraling cords of self replicating DNA. And that explains everything. It puts it all in perspective. Our existence is so full of meaning now. Here's the key to unlocking everything and to make everything right. It's all there in our DNA. That's the truth is in us all along. Now, if that idea doesn't sound good enough for you, if seeking the answer in the DNA helix doesn't answer life's meanings, it's sort of like trying to find the secret of Van Gogh's paintings by studying paint chemistry. Then, you know, where do we find our answers then? What is the answer? Is it all just here in us, or is there something beyond us? Is there something outside of us, further than us, to have the answer? See, my point is simply this. If we're just a microscopic dot in this universe, is there nothing beyond us? Is there something beyond what we're here, or is this it? See, these are the questions. Is this all that there is? Are you willing to accept that? If you're willing to accept the purely naturalistic view of universe, that's all there is, and if you could find meaning and purpose, you know, fine. But if you're not ready to accept the notion that you and your dreams and your hopes and your ideas are nothing but, I think Bertrand Russell once said, lumps of impure carbon and water? Are you sensing from reason alone that the universe is not sufficiently self-explanatory? You know, to believe that it arose from yourself, supposedly a dot the size of a pupil, that's what the Big Bang, there was this teeny thing about the size of a human pupil, and from that everything existed, and that's the beginning. If you're not satisfied with that, if you think there's more than just what atoms in the void, then I challenge you to take a look at the claims of Jesus Christ about who he is and what he came to do. Because I believe that through him you could find the meaning of the transcendent that Faber-Goslos thought he found in those statues, only to lose everything.